Hi, and welcome to episode 3 of the Philosophy and Film podcast, produced in partnership with the Hyde Park Picture House in Leeds. My name's Joe Saunders, I'm a philosopher at Durham University, and for the past few years I've run a regular philosophy and film series at the Picture House. This year, with the cinema closed, we thought we'd give a podcast a go, as a way of continuing some of the interesting discussions we've already begun, as well as to start some exciting new ones. So the way this works is that in each episode I'll be joined by a different guest philosopher who will each nominate a film for us to discuss. We'll then explore whether we can learn anything about the film from philosophy, but also whether the world of philosophy has anything to learn from the film. One of the most special times of the year to visit the Hyde Park Picture House is at Christmas, when the cinema screams the hugely popular It's a Wonderful Life. Sadly though, this will be the first year in decades that the film isn't screened, so we wanted to find another way to keep the tradition alive and to pay tribute to a film that for so many continues to mean so much. That's why, for this week's episode, we're delighted to be joined by Professor Shannon Day for a discussion about Frank Capra's festive classic. Shannon is a professor in philosophy and the Dean of Arts at the University of Regina in Canada, and I caught up with her via Zoom just a few days ago. Hi, Shannon. Thanks so much for joining us. So just jumping right in, what was the last thing you watched?
I watched The Social Dilemma, which was a documentary about social media and its pernicious effects on people.
Yeah, I saw that the other day as well. Completely terrifying. Did you think there was anything kind of philosophically interesting or significant about it?
Well, I mean, I have to say I had epistemological worries about the film because I ultimately agreed with the main conclusion of the film, but I thought that the filmmakers used some really manipulative rhetoric to try to persuade audience members to that conclusion, and we philosophers tend to regard that as what's called sophism and would rather that people arrive at the correct conclusion through the right kinds of reason and evidence. And it wasn't logic and evidence, ultimately, I think, that was the most effective in that film, but some really manipulative personifications of technology that really resists personification if you understand how it works.
Yeah, it's really funny you say that. I had a similar worry with it, but weirdly, it caused me to do some things. So I've heard very many, you know, rationally persuasive and better put cases against social media, and I always go, oh yeah, very interesting, and then go back to social media, where this film made me go into my phone and turn off the notifications for all my social media apps in a similar way. I was thinking, when I've listened to philosophers and people really make the case for, you know, not eating meat or something, I thought, well, that's an interesting case. But then when I watched Blackfish, the documentary about orcas, which I think is, you know, maybe less so, but it's probably, you know, maybe there's some manipulative stuff going on there as well. It worked. It was more effective.
Well, I struggle with that a little bit. I asked myself whether I thought the ends justify the means in this case. If people could be more careful with their social media as a result of watching this film, did I mind the kind of lie at the heart of the film? And I haven't quite decided where I've landed on that, but I will say, and I think it's great if the film motivates people to change their social media habits, because we all need to be a lot more careful about how we use social media. But I worry about the individualizing of blame. I think that ultimately the responsibility and the opportunity to really address the challenges of social media are the corporate and state level, not the individual level. This is like all of the people who are trying to address climate change and global warming by dutifully recycling their tin cans each week, while most of the results of climate change, or most of the causes of climate change, are produced by a handful of corporations.
Yeah, I suppose there's work. I'm thinking about work done on ethics of manipulation and advertising and political communication and things like that as well. So, you know, the ethics of advertising for charities. So you've got, like you were saying, with the ends justifying the means, you've got some good cause, right? But there are worries that if you're too emotionally manipulative in how you get people to support that cause, then something's gone wrong. And I suppose when you talk to people putting forward this political communication, not that I've talked to them, but my hunch is that they'd say, well, look, you know, that's just the playing field now. And I suppose that came up in the documentary as well, right? Look, this is the playing field we're dealing with. It's not fair. We've got to kind of fight on these terms. And maybe there's, I don't know, maybe there's a bit of that. I'm conscious that we could probably talk about this for an entire episode. And maybe we should at some point, because I think it's a really interesting film and really timely. But I guess It's a Wonderful Life is also timely. So, yeah, so let's talk about that. So the way this is normally structured is around kind of two main questions. The first one is whether you think there's anything we can learn about watching the film or thinking about the film from the world of philosophy. So let's start there.
Yeah. First of all, the title, It's a Wonderful Life, I think nods to one of the great themes of philosophy, and that's the question of what is the good life? And I think that ultimately the film is really asking that question, what is the good life? And comes to the kind of optimistic conclusion that if you are living a good life, then that's wonderful enough. So the protagonist, George Bailey, dreams of world travel and of professional accomplishments and of all of these exciting things outside of his little town of Bedford Falls. But one circumstance after another keeps him in Bedford Falls. So he's never able to do the wonderful things he imagines. But at the end of the day, looking back over the course of his life, which is indeed a good life by any moral standard, I can say a little bit more about that. It turns out that that's enough, that at the end of the day, living a good life is more important than traveling the world or building skyscrapers. In terms of that question of what is the good life, I find myself in thinking about this film, wanting to structure an entire undergraduate ethics course around it. Because as you know, undergraduate ethics courses are often divided into kind of four chunks. We look through, first of all, virtue ethics, which focuses on who is a good person. What does it mean to be a good person? What are the standards for being a good person? And then we look at deontology, which asks what are our duties and makes the case that acting from those duties is what makes us good. The third kind of structure we usually use, or the third division we usually use, is some kind of consequentialism, where we look at what kinds of effects we have in the world. And then we usually tack on some feminist ethics, which look at things like interdependence and relationality and vulnerability. And in fact, you can assess George Bailey on all four of those criteria. You could run an entire course looking at George Bailey as a model of the virtuous agent, as somebody who acts from duty, even when his inclinations take him in a different direction, as someone who brings about good consequences in the world, and as someone who at the end of the day is defined by his positive, loving relationships with all of their fragility and interdependence.
Nice, that sounds like a good course.
I know, right?
There was an article in The Guardian in 2015 where philosophers were asked about films and philosophical lessons from films. And Christine Korsgaard chose It's a Wonderful Life, and she's got a couple of paragraphs on it. And she says that it's something similar, that, you know, the old question that whether a life that is morally good is also good in the sense that it makes you happy is answered in the affirmative. According to the movie, what's good about the morally good life is the way it connects you to other people and, as you say, it makes you happy. But it's interesting thinking that... So Christine Korsgaard is one of the most famous Kantian ethicists on the planet. And as you said, Shannon, George's life kind of, you might think, succeeds on a kind of like Kantian understanding because he does the right thing because it's the right thing and often does it at the expense of his own happiness. But, you know, I guess the kind of like the Kantian in me worries that you could live a really morally good life but be thoroughly miserable, right?
Yeah, and I mean, the movie kind of explores that. It begins with him being thoroughly miserable. Before we ever meet George, we hear that he is in crisis. And there's a kind of discussion among angels in the heavens about this man who's in crisis and someone has to go and help him. And so we know that he is thoroughly miserable at the outset. And then Clarence the angel is given a kind of a filmic version of George's life. He gets to see his life up to from his childhood up to the point where he becomes miserable to see what kind of man he is. And so we see him miserable at the beginning. And then by the time that Clarence arrives on the scene, George is on a bridge thinking about committing suicide because he's so miserable. So it takes very seriously the idea that always doing the right thing can make you deeply unhappy sometimes, right? That's where the Aristotelianism comes in, though, because those moments of deep unhappiness are moments, right? There's a wonderful line in Aristotle, "One swallow does not a summer make." And he uses that line in service of the idea that we should judge a person based on the whole of their lives, not on their best moments or their worst moments, that to judge someone by their peaks and valleys is to misjudge them.
I mentioned this before we started recording, but I should just note for that this is the first time I ever watched this film was last night. I've been meaning to watch it, but, you know, I've heard it's a great film, so I was waiting for the right opportunity. But one of the things that struck me last night that I wasn't expecting was how kind of, yeah, like you said, kind of morally complex George was. And in particular, what hit me tonight, I'd be interested to hear what you had to say about perhaps the portrayal of masculinity in a film like this, you know, an old Hollywood classic. I wasn't expecting such a kind of complex portrayal of masculinity, if you think that's what's going on.
No, I think that's quite complex. And think about when the film was released. It was released in 1946. And one of the, and so, you know, the war had just ended. And one of the central events in George's life is that his brother goes off to war and everybody else in town goes off to war. There's a scene in which Mr. Potter, who's the kind of villain in the film, but who also works for the draft board, is approving everyone to go off to war. And George, because of his disability, is unable to go to war. And there were incredible expectations at the time around real men going to war. There was an association of masculinity with military service. And so one of the points that this film makes, and I think it does this in a bunch of other ways as well, but this is just one example in terms of the representation of masculinity. One of the points that the film makes is that someone can be vulnerable and unable to engage in the kind of heroics that we so often associate with masculinity and still be, by any measure, a good man, right? I mean, the film is inevitably gendered, right? He is very much one of the men of the community, one of the business leaders on whom the community depends, and that's very much a gendered business. But he fails some of the standards of masculinity of his day, which again makes him wonderfully kind of interesting and human rather than some kind of heroic idealization.
Yeah, I was having a conversation with some friends the other day, and I was just thinking, like, recall your childhood. Can you think of examples of men who were, you know, role model-esque type men, right? Either, you know, people you looked up to in your family or the community, or people you saw on the screen who you thought, that's the type of man that I want to be like, who openly cried in a way that wasn't seen as a failing or a real weakness. And I, you know, we struggled, and now I haven't, then I watched this the day after, and now I have an answer.
You know, the other moment of kind of vulnerability and a different representation of masculinity that I hadn't thought about till this moment, but after Clarence the Angel has taken George through what the world would be like without him, George is back on the bridge, and he's now back in reality, but he's not sure. And how does he check to see whether he's back in reality? He puts his hand in his pocket to see whether the flower petals from his youngest daughter, Zuzu, are in there. There's something lovely about the fact that flower petals from a little girl are the thing that confirm for him that the world is real.
So there's two half thoughts in my head. I'm going to try and pull them together. So one is this thought that this is a didactic film, so that there is some lesson here to be learned, and there's some sort of lesson that Capra's trying to teach us. And the lesson is roughly something along the lines of, a morally good life is a wonderful life. But at the same time, the thought that this is an eminently rewatchable film, and that people, it's a film that people have a relationship and they rewatch every year. So the Picture House, I know, shows this every Christmas, and I was doing a little bit of kind of cursory reading around it, and I read that Roger Ebert made this point that, you know, some great films you watch once. That's the best amount of times to watch them, whereas this is one you just want to watch over and over again. And I wonder if they're related. So I wonder if the lesson of this film and the fact that it sustains or rewards these kind of multiple watchings are somehow linked. Does that make any sense?
It does make sense. And I think, again, I started this conversation by remarking on the fact that you could approach the ethics of It's a Wonderful Life using many different lenses because it's so rich. And I think that that's one thing. Even the didacticism is kind of rich and allows you different ways in on different viewings. Sometimes I watch the film and really, you know, the last time I watched it, I watched it in a very Aristotelian way, and I kept thinking about George Bailey as the exemplar of the virtuous agent whom we should all aspire to resemble. Sometimes I watch the film and find myself really focusing on the consequences of a world without George and thinking about all the things he's brought into the world. So even the didacticism is more complex than you would expect from a sort of pat moral story. But it's not merely didactic. It's also got a great script and hilarious moments. And as you say, that moment where they're dancing and the floor opens and everyone ends up in the pool is a moment of just pure joy. It's delightful to watch. It's delightful every single time you watch it. And if you watch it enough times, it's delightful in anticipation. You know, last night I watched it again, and as I started dancing again, I remembered what was going to happen. And I noticed, of course, earlier on, just before the dance, when George's father said, "It's a new floor, I hope it holds out." Or maybe George's brother said that. But they, you know, there's this wonderful little bit of foreshadowing. And I got to sort of snicker a little bit, anticipating the wonderful thing that would happen.
Yeah, it's a, oh, I sure hope no one falls in this swimming pool that we've got on. I suppose with the hope, the structure of the podcast, and it never really seems to work this way, but it's that we'll discuss for a bit what we can learn about the film from the world of philosophy. But then in a weird way, I maybe think maybe even more interesting question is whether there's anything the world of philosophy or philosophers or particular literatures could learn or be reminded of from viewing the film. Do you think there's anything there?
Yeah, I thought about that. And there are a couple of things. And again, I kept thinking about how fun it would be to use the film as the kind of backbone for an ethics course in general. And something that sometimes irritates me in discussions about ethics among philosophers is this idea that you have to choose your team and stick to it. You know, are you a deontologist or are you a virtue ethicist? What is your approach to ethics? And I've never been convinced that we ought to choose. I think that if we've got lots of sensible ways to assess our moral conduct and to help guide us toward the good life, I'm inclined to be a pluralist and use a bunch of them. And so one of the things that I think that the film reinforces is that it makes a lot of sense to think about whether someone lives a good life over the course of a whole life. One swallow does not a summer make. It makes a lot of sense to ask whether someone is acting from duty, even when it goes against their own inclinations, their own desire for happiness. It makes a lot of sense to assess what our consequences are in the world. And I don't think we should have to choose between them. And George is this rich example of someone we can assess on all of those standards. And again, on that kind of feminist standard that looks and takes seriously at things like interdependence and fragility and relationships. It looks at ethics as something that happens between people and not just within isolated Lego piece individuals that are all separate in the world. So that's something that I think philosophy could really learn from It's a Wonderful Life. But I also think philosophers need to focus more than we do on the kind of material realities of the world. We have a tendency to idealize away from reality and to reason rather abstractly. And one of the things that amazes me about this film is that in that final scene in which we're all blubbering and crying, of course, because you can't help but cry, people keep coming into George's house and dumping crumpled up dollar bills on his table until he's got a mountain of money in front of him. And in most films, someone with a mountain of money in front of them would be the villain. And that wouldn't be a moving scene. That would be, you know, something that follows a heist or whatever. And it's always amazed me that I can be so moved by human kindness in a scene in which half of the screen is money, right? But I think that one of the lessons of the film is that human beings occupy material conditions. We aren't just ideas. We're flesh and blood, and we need homes and we need food. And those sorts of dependencies affect the kinds of lives we can lead and affect our judgment of what is the good life.
Yeah, this is making me think that this is something that comes up in a lot of Christmas films. And I'm wondering what you think about it. So you said, you know, he ends with this pile of money on his table. And in other situations, we'd, you know, be uncomfortable as viewers, like, boo, you know, oh, look, you got all your money. Yeah. But I think from my hazy memory at the minute that a lot of Christmas films end with something similar. So thinking about like the Griswolds at Christmas, it looks like there's this big, they're trying to have a happy Christmas, which is one which they can afford to buy each other presents or, you know, in the Muppets Christmas Carol. Yeah, you want one in which you can afford a turkey to sit around and eat. And often there's a threat to that. And that's portrayed as really devastating. And part of the kind of emotional climax of the film is that you get these material goods. But and I suppose that the bit where I'm always uneasy is you don't want to tip over into a kind of materialism where a wonderful or good life is the one of just having these things, but you also have to recognize how important these are to us. Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Absolutely. But look at the really brave thing that It's a Wonderful Life does compared to all those other Christmas films. You're absolutely right. It is a trope of Christmas films to end with bounty. So a turkey on the table and gifts under the tree and raising a glass. But that bounty is always food and gifts and so forth. To actually make it a heap of money, that's taking a huge risk. If I asked you, name a Christmas movie with a character with a load of money, you would probably name one of the versions of A Christmas Carol, right? Because we associate Scrooge with a pile of money, because we associate having a pile of money with being greedy and having the wrong values in life. And I actually wonder whether It's a Wonderful Life wasn't intended as a purposeful contrast with A Christmas Carol. Because if you think about it, in A Christmas Carol, Scrooge also gets to see what life would be like without him. And it turns out life is better without him. Scrooge has never improved anyone's lives. When Scrooge, what changes Scrooge's approach to the world is seeing that a world without him is better. What changes George Bailey's approach to the world is seeing that a world without him is worse. They both have a pile of money in front of them on the table, but they mean very different things.
I guess this would be useful if friends or family of yours are listening. They know they can give you cash for Christmas.
Yeah, just birthdays. Give me cash because I'm a good person. I'm living a good life. I like it wadded up.
Okay, cool. So is there anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to kind of get in, or?
I don't think so. We were pretty thorough, don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean, Nate, okay, so one thing. Actually, you and I, before we started recording, I told you that this film makes me cry earlier than any other film does, and that's the scene in which the pharmacist who employs George has just learned that his son has died. And so in his despair and distress, he makes a dangerous error with the medication that George is meant to deliver. So George doesn't deliver it because he understands the error that's been made. And the pharmacist becomes enraged and starts beating George, and George's bad ear starts to bleed, and George is crying and saying, "Please don't hit my sore ear, please don't hit my sore ear." And I burst into tears every time I watch that. What amazes me about this film, it's such a generous film. I don't think I can remember a single other film in which someone assaults a child and there's an opportunity for redemption afterwards. But this film offers the chemist an opportunity for redemption and offers it through George's generosity and George's understanding that grief can make us do terrible things, but that we, again, should judge a person by the course of their whole life and not by their worst moments. And that chemist becomes one of the closest friends and supporters for George in the rest of the film. That the opportunity for forgiveness and redemption that is offered in that moment is astonishing, and I can't think of another film that pulls it off.
I was wondering, again, watching it, thinking, oh God, I haven't watched this. What am I going to be like? What am I be missing having only watched this once? And I think one of the things I think is that, like, so this has been a difficult year, right? This is 2020 still when the podcast comes out. It's been a difficult and trying year. A lot of people are grumpy and tired and frustrated and all of these things. And I think that one nice thing that Christmas movies do is remind you that everyone goes through those kind of trials and ups and downs, but the things that make life worth living are the little goods you do and the people around you. And I thought, I wish that I'd watched this every year. What a beautiful film to watch every year. I watch Home Alone every year. I mean, also a great film, but it just makes me want to, like, be a mischievous child or whatever. Or I watch Elf and it makes me want to be just a big goofball. But this, you know...
Yeah, this one reminds us to take the long view and to be forgiving with others and with ourselves.
The Philosophy and Film podcast was edited by Ollie Jenkins with music from Nathan Mosley. It's a Hyde Park Picture House production. Thanks so much, Shannon, for being such a great guest, and to all of you for listening. If you have any thoughts on the topics discussed or ideas for films that you'd like to hear featured, we'd love to hear from you. You can use the hashtag philosophyfilm or email info@hydeparkpicturehouse.co.uk. Looking ahead, we have a bunch of exciting new films and philosophers lined up for next year. But until then, stay safe, Merry Christmas, and Happy New Year.